This is Audible.
Another Life by Kristen Hanna. Read by Susan Erickson.
Once again, for Benjamin and Tucker. For good friends, Holly and Gerald, Mark and Monica, Tom and Lori, Megan and Kaney, and Steve and Jill. And finally, a special thanks to Linda Merrow for an effort that was above and beyond the call of duty. Chapter 1. The streets of West End were crowded on this unexpectedly sunny day. All across town, mothers stood in open doorways, with hands tented across their eyes, watching their children play. Everyone knew that soon, probably tomorrow, a soapy haze would creep across the sky, covering the blue, obliterating the delicate sun, and once more the rain would fall. It was May, after all, in the Pacific Northwest. Rain came to this month as surely as ghosts took to the streets on the 31st of October and salmon came home from the sea. "It sure is hot," Conlon said from the driver's seat of the sleek black BMW convertible. It was the first thing he'd said in almost an hour. He was trying to make conversation, that was all. Angie should return the volley. Perhaps mention the beautiful hawthorn trees that were in bloom. But even as she had the thought, she was exhausted by it. In a few short months, those tiny green leaves would begin to curl and blacken. The color would be drawn out of them by the cold nights, and they would fall to the ground unnoticed. When you looked at it that way, what was the point in noticing so fleeting a moment? She stared out the window at her hometown. It was the first time she'd been back in months. Although West End was only 120 miles from Seattle, that distance had seemed to swell lately in her mind. As much as she loved her family, she'd found it difficult to leave her own house. Out in the world, there were babies everywhere. They drove into the old part of town, where Victorian houses had been built one after another on tiny patches of lawn. Huge, leafy maple trees shaded the street, cast an intricate lacework pattern of light on the asphalt. In the 70s, this neighborhood had been the town's heart. Kids had been everywhere back then, riding their big wheels and Schwinn bicycles from one house to the next. There had been block parties every Sunday after church and games of Red Rover played in every backyard. In the years between then and now, this part of the state had changed, and the old neighborhoods had fallen into silence and disrepair. Salmon runs had diminished, and the timber industry had been hit hard. People who had once made their living from the land and the sea had been pushed aside, forgotten. New residents built their houses in clusters, in subdivisions named after the very trees they cut down. But here, on this small patch of Maple Drive, time had stood still. The last house on the block looked exactly as it had for 40 years. The white paint was pure and perfect. The emerald green trim glistened. No weed had ever been allowed to flourish in the lawn. Angie's father had tended to this house for 4 decades. It had been his pride and joy. Every Monday, after a weekend of hard work at the family's restaurant, he'd devoted a full 12-hour day to home and garden maintenance. In the 6 months since his death, Angie's mother had tried to follow that routine. It had become her solace, her way of connecting with the man she'd loved for almost 50 years, and when she tired of the hard work, someone was always ready to lend a hand. Such help, Mama often reminded them, was the advantage to having 3 daughters, her payoff, she claimed, for surviving their teen years. Conlon pulled up to the curb and parked. As the convertible top shushed mechanically into place, he turned to Angie. "Are you sure you're okay with this?"
"I need to do it. I miss my family."
"It's been 4 months since—" "I know how long it's been. I'm here, aren't I?" She turned to look at him finally. He was exhausted. She saw the glint of it in his blue eyes, but knew he wouldn't say more, wouldn't say anything that might remind her of the baby they'd lost. They sat there, side by side, in silence. The air conditioner made a soft whooshing noise. The old Conlan would have leaned over and kissed her now, would have told her he loved her, and those few and tender words would have saved her. But they were past such comfort these days. The love she'd once felt for him felt far, far away, as faded and lost as her childhood. "We could leave right now. Say the car broke down," he said, trying to be the man he used to be, the man who could tease his wife into smiling. She didn't look at him. "Are you kidding? They all think we paid too much for this car. Besides, Mama already knows we're here. She might talk to dead people, but she has the hearing of a bat. She's in the kitchen making 10,000 cannoli for 20 people, and your sisters haven't stopped talking since they walked in the door. We could escape in the confusion." He smiled. For a moment, everything felt normal between them, as if there were no ghosts on the seat. She wished it were an ease that could last. "Livy cooked 3 casseroles," she muttered. "Mira probably crocheted a new tablecloth and made us all matching aprons. Last week, you had 2 pitch meetings and a commercial shoot. It's hardly worth your time to cook." Poor Conlan. 14 years of marriage, and he still didn't understand the dynamics of the DeSaria family. Cooking was more than a job or a hobby. It was a kind of currency, and Angie was broke. Her papa, whom she'd idolized, had loved that she couldn't cook. He took it as a badge of success. To an immigrant who'd come to this country with $4 in his pocket and made a living feeding other immigrant families, he'd been proud that his youngest daughter made money using her head rather than her hands. "Let's go," she said, not wanting to think about Papa. Angie got out of the car and went around to the trunk. It opened silently, revealing a narrow cardboard box. Inside was an extravagantly rich chocolate cake made by the Pacific Dessert Company and a to-die-for lemon tart. She reached down for it, knowing some comment would be made about her inability to cook. As the youngest daughter, the princess, she'd been allowed to color or talk on the phone or watch TV while her sisters worked in the kitchen. None of her sisters ever let her forget that Papa had spoiled her mercilessly. As adults, her sisters still worked in the family restaurant. That was real work, they always said, unlike Angie's career in advertising. "Come on," Conlan said, taking her arm. They walked up the concrete walkway, past the fountain of the Virgin Mary, and up the steps. A statue of Christ stood by the door, his hands outstretched in greeting. Someone had hung an umbrella from his wrist. Conlan knocked perfunctorily and opened the door. The house rattled with noise. Loud voices, kids running up and down the stairs, ice buckets being refilled, laughter. Every piece of furniture in the foyer was buried beneath a layer of coats and shoes and empty food boxes. Angie knew where the women would be, so she headed for the kitchen. The family room was full of children playing games. Candyland for the younger kids, Crazy Eights for the older. Her eldest nephew, Jason, and her niece, Sarah, were playing Nintendo on the television. At Angie's entrance, the kids squealed and flocked to her, all talking at once, vying for her attention. From their earliest memories, she was the aunt who would get down on the floor and play with whatever toy was in at the moment. She never turned down their music or said that a movie was unsuitable. When asked, they all said Aunt Angie was way cool. She heard Conlan behind her, talking to Mira's husband, Vince. A drink was being poured. She eased through the crowd of kids and walked down the hallway. At the edge of the kitchen, she paused. Mama stood at the oversized butcher's block in the center of the room, rolling out the sweet dough. Flour obscured half of her face and dusted her hair. Her eyeglasses, a holdover from the 70s, had lenses the size of saucers and magnified her brown eyes. Tiny beads of sweat collected along her brow and slid down her flowery cheeks, landing on her bosom in little blobs of dough. In the 6 months since Papa's passing, she'd lost too much weight and stopped dyeing her hair. It was snow white now. Mira stood at the stove, dropping gnocchi into a pot of boiling water. From behind, she looked like a girl. Even after bearing 4 children, she was still tiny, almost bird-like. And since she often wore her teenage daughter's clothes, she appeared 10 years younger than her 41 years. Tonight, her long black hair was held back in a braid that snaked almost to her waist. She wore a pair of low-rise, flare-legged black pants and a cable-knit red sweater. She was talking now. There was no surprise in that. She was always talking. Papa had always joked that his eldest daughter sounded like a blender on high speed. Livy was standing off to the left, slicing fresh mozzarella. She looked like a big pen in her black silk sheath. The only thing higher than her heels was the teased puffiness of her hair. Long ago, Livy had left West End in a rush, certain that she could become a model. She'd stayed in Los Angeles until the sentence, "Could you please undress now?" started to accompany every job interview. 5 years ago, just after her 34th birthday, she'd come home, bitter at her lack of success, defeated by the effort, dragging with her 2 young sons who had been fathered by a man none of the family had ever seen or met. She'd gone to work at the family restaurant, but she didn't like it. She saw herself as a big city girl trapped in a small town. Now she was engaged, again. Everyone hoped that Salvatore Trena, lucky choice number 3, would finally make her happy. Angie smiled. So much of her time had been spent in this kitchen with these 3 women. No matter how old she got or what direction her life took, this would always be home. In Mama's kitchen, you were safe and warm and well-loved. Though she and her sisters had chosen different lives and tended too often to meddle in each other's choices, they were like strands of a single rope. When they came together, they were unbreakable. She stepped into the kitchen and put the box down on the table. "Hey, guys!" Livy and Mira surged forward, enfolded her in a hug that smelled of Italian spices and drugstore perfume. They held her tightly. Angie felt the wetness of tears on her neck, but nothing was said except, "It's good to have you home." "Thanks." She gave her sisters 1 last tight hug, then went to Mama, who opened her arms. Angie stepped into the warmth of that embrace. As always, Mama smelled of thyme, taboo perfume, and Aquanet hairspray, the scents of Angie's youth. Mama hugged her so tightly that Angie had to draw in a gulp of air. Laughing, she tried to step back, but Mama held on. Angie stiffened instinctively. The last time Mama had held Angie this tightly, Mama had whispered, "You'll try again. God will give you another baby." Angie pulled out of the embrace. "Don't," she said, trying to smile. That did it. Just that quietly voiced plea. Mama reached for the Parmesan grater and said, "Dinner's ready. Mira, get the kids to the table." The dining room held 14 people comfortably, and 20 tonight. An ancient mahogany table, brought here from the old country, held center stage in a big windowless room papered in rose and burgundy. An ornate wooden crucifix hung on the wall beside a portrait of Jesus. Adults and children were crammed around the table. Dean Martin sang in the other room. "Let us pray," Mama said as soon as everyone was seated. When silence didn't fall instantly, she reached over and thwopped Uncle Francis in the head. Francis dropped his chin and closed his eyes. Everyone followed suit and began the prayer. Their voices joined as one. "Bless us, O Lord, and these thy gifts, which we are about to receive from thy bounty through Christ our Lord. Amen." When the prayer ended, Mama stood up quickly, raised her wine glass. "We drink a toast now, to Sal and Olivia." Her voice vibrated, her mouth trembled. "I do not know what to say. Toasting is a man's job." She abruptly sat down. Mira touched Mama's shoulder and stood up.
"We welcome Sal to our family. May you two find the kind of love that Mama and Papa had. May you have full cupboards and warm bedrooms and..."
She paused, her voice softened. "Many healthy babies." Instead of laughter and clapping and clanking glasses, there was silence. Angie drew a sharp breath and looked up at her sisters.
"I'm not pregnant," Livy said quickly. "But we're trying."
Angie managed to smile, although it was wobbly and weak. Everyone was looking at her, wondering how she would handle another baby in the family. They all tried so hard not to bruise her. She raised her glass.
"To Sal and Livy," she spoke quickly, hoping her tears would pass for joy. "May you have many healthy babies."
Conversations started up again. The table became a frenzy of clanging forks and knives, scratching on porcelain, and laughter. Although this family gathered for every holiday and two Monday nights a month, they never ran out of things to say. Angie glanced around the table. Mira was talking animatedly to Mama about a school fundraiser that needed to be catered. Vince and Uncle Francis were arguing about last week's Husky Ducks game. Sal and Livy were kissing every now and then. The younger kids were spitting peas at one another, and the older ones were arguing about whether Xbox or PlayStation was better. Conlon was asking Aunt Julia about her upcoming hip replacement surgery. Angie couldn't concentrate on any of it. She certainly couldn't make idle conversation. Her sister wanted a baby, and so it would happen. Livy would probably get pregnant between Leno and the news.
"Oops, I forgot my diaphragm."
That was how it happened for her sisters. After dinner, as Angie washed the dishes, no one spoke to her, but everyone who walked past the sink squeezed her shoulder or kissed her cheek. Everyone knew there were no more words to say. Hopes and prayers had been offered so many times over the years they'd lost their sheen. Mama had kept a candle burning at St. Cecilia's for almost a decade now, and still it would be Angie and Conlon alone in the car tonight. A couple who'd never multiplied into a family. Finally, she couldn't stand it anymore. She tossed the dish rag on the table and went up to her old bedroom. The pretty little room, still wallpapered in roses and white baskets, held twin beds ruffled in pink bedding. Ironically, she'd once knelt by this very bed and prayed not to be pregnant. She'd been 17 at the time, dating Tommy Matucci, her first love. The door opened, and Conlon walked in. Her big, black-haired Irishman husband looked ridiculously out of place in her little girl's room.
"I'm fine," she said.
"Yeah, right." She heard the bitterness in his voice, felt stung by it. There was nothing she could do, though. He couldn't comfort her. God knew that had been proven often enough. "You need help," he said it tiredly, and no wonder. The words were old.
"I'm fine."
He stared at her for a long time. The blue eyes that had once looked at her with adoration now held an almost unbearable defeat. With a sigh, he turned and left the room, closing the door behind him. A few moments later, it opened again. Mama stood in the doorway, her fists planted on her narrow hips. The shoulder pads on her Sunday dress were Blade Runner big and practically touched the doorframe on either side.
"You always did run to your room when you were sad or angry."
Angie scooted sideways to make room. "And you always came running up after me.
Your father made me." "You never knew that, did you?"
Mama sat down on the edge of the bed beside Angie. The old mattress sagged beneath their weight.
"He could not stand to see you cry. Poor Livy could shriek her lungs out and he never noticed. But you, You were his princess. One tear could break his heart.
She sighed. It was a heavy sound, full of disappointment and empathy.
You're 38 years old, Angela, Mama said. It's time to grow up. Your papa, God rest his soul, would have agreed with me on this.
I don't even know what that means. Mama slipped an arm around her, pulled her close.
God has given you an answer to your prayers, Angela. It is not the answer you wanted, so you don't hear. It's time to listen.
Angie woke with a start. The coolness on her cheeks was from tears. She'd had the baby dream again, the one in which she and Conlon stood on opposite shores. Between them, on the shimmering expanse of blue sea, was a tiny pink-swaddled bundle. Inch by inch, it floated away and disappeared. When it was gone, they were left alone, she and Conlon, standing too far apart. It was the same dream she'd been having for years, as she and her husband trudged from doctor's office to doctor's office, trying one procedure after another. Supposedly, she was one of the lucky ones. In 8 years, she'd conceived 3 children. 2 had been miscarriages. 1, her daughter Sophia, had lived for only a few short days. That had been the end of it. Neither she nor Conlon had the heart to try again. She eased away from her husband, grabbed her pink chenille robe off the floor, and left the bedroom. The shadowy hallway waited for her. To her right, dozens of family photographs, all framed in thick mahogany, covered the wall, portraits of 5 generations of Desarias and Malones. She looked down the long hallway at the last closed door. The brass knob glinted with moonlight from the nearby window. When was the last time she dared to enter that room? God has given you an answer. It's time to listen. She walked slowly past the stairs, past the vacant guest room, to the final door. There. She drew in a deep breath and exhaled it. Her hands were trembling as she opened the door and went inside. The air felt heavy in here, old and musty. She turned on the light and closed the door behind her. The room was so perfect. She closed her eyes as if darkness could help. The sweet notes of Beauty and the Beast filled her mind, took her back in time to the first time she'd closed the door on this room so many years ago. It was after they'd decided on adoption. "We have a baby, Mrs. Malone. The mother, a teenager, chose you and Conlon. Come down to my office and meet her." It had taken Angie the full 4 hours until their appointment to choose the outfit and do her makeup. When she and Conlon finally met Sarah Decker in the lawyer's office, the 3 of them had bonded instantly. "We'll love your child," Angie had promised the girl. "You can trust us." For 6 wonderful months, they'd given up trying to get pregnant. Sex had become fun again. They'd fallen effortlessly back in love. Life had been good. There had been hope in this house. They'd celebrated with their families. They'd brought Sarah into their home and shared their hearts with her. They'd accompanied her to every OB appointment. 2 weeks before her due date, Sarah had come home with some stencils and paint. She and Angie had decorated this room. A sky blue ceiling and walls, crowded by puffy white clouds. White picket fencing entwined with bright flowers, their colorful faces attended to by bees and butterflies and fairies. The first sign of disaster had come on the day Sarah went into labor. Angie and Conlon had been at work. They'd come home to an empty, too quiet house with no message on the answering machine and no note on the kitchen table. They'd been home less than an hour when the phone rang. They'd huddled by the phone together, holding hands, crying with happiness when they heard of the birth. It had taken a moment for the other words to register. Even now, Angie only remembered bits and pieces of the conversation. "I'm sorry. changed her mind. Back with her boyfriend. Keeping the baby. They'd shut the door to this room and kept it closed. Once a week, their cleaning woman ventured inside, but Angie and Conlon never did. For well over a year, this room had stood empty, a shrine to their dream of someday. They'd given up on all of it. The doctors, the treatments, the injections, and the procedures. Then, miraculously, Angie had conceived again. By the time she was 5 months pregnant, they dared once more to enter this room and fill it with their dreams. They'd been killing her slowly, those dreams, ruining her. She went to the closet and pulled out a big cardboard box. One by one, she began to put things away, trying not to attach memories to every piece she touched. Hey. She hadn't even heard the door open, and yet here he was, in the room with her. She knew how crazy it must seem to him, to find his wife sitting in the middle of the room with a big cardboard box beside her. Inside it were all of her precious knick-knacks, the Winnie the Pooh bedside lamp, the Aladdin picture frame, the crisp new collection of Dr. Seuss. The only piece of furniture left was the crib. The bedding was on the floor beside it, a neat little stack of pale pink flannel. She turned to look up at him. There were tears in her eyes, blurring her vision, but she hadn't noticed until now. She wanted to tell him how sorry she was. It had all gone wrong between them. She picked up a small pink stack of sheets, stroking the fabric. "It made me crazy," was all she could say. He sat down beside her. She waited for him to speak, but he just sat there, watching her. She understood. The past had taught him caution. Between the fertility drugs and the broken dreams, Angie's emotions were a seesaw ride. "I forgot about us," she said. "There is no us, Angie." The gentle way he said it broke her heart. Finally, one of them had dared to say it. "I know. I wanted a baby, too." She swallowed hard, trying to keep her tears under control. She'd forgotten that in the last few years. Conlon had dreamed of fatherhood just as she wanted motherhood. Somewhere along the way, it had all become about her. She'd focused so much on her own grief that his had become incidental. It was one of those realizations that would haunt her, she knew. She had always been dedicated to success in her life. Her family called her obsessive, and becoming a mother had been one more goal to attain. She should have remembered that it was a team sport. "I'm sorry," she said again. He took her in his arms and kissed her. It was the kind of kiss they hadn't shared in years. They sat that way, entwined, for a long time. She wished his love could have been enough for her. It should have been. But her need for a child had been like a high tide, an overwhelming force that had drowned them. Maybe a year ago she could have kicked to the surface. Not now. "I loved you."
"I know."
"We should have been more careful." Later that night, when she was alone in the bed they'd bought together, she tried to remember the hows and whys of it, the things they'd said to one another at the end of their love. But none of it came back to her. All she could really remember was the smell of baby powder and the sound of his voice when he said goodbye. Chapter 2. It was amazing how much time it took to dismantle a life. Once Angie and Conlon had decided to end their marriage, details became what mattered. How to divide everything in half, especially the indivisible things like houses and cars and hearts. They spent months on the details of divorce, and by late September, it was done. Her house, no, it was the Petersons' house now, was empty. Instead of bedrooms and a designer living room, and a granite-layered kitchen. She had a sizable amount of money in the bank, a storage facility filled with 50% of their furniture, and a trunk full of suitcases. Angie sat on the brick hearth, staring out across the gleaming gold of her hardwood floors. There had been blue carpeting in here on the day she and Conlon had moved in.
Hardwood, they'd said to each other, smiling at the ease of their agreement and the power of their dream. Kids are so hard on carpet.
So long ago. 10 years in this house. It felt like a lifetime. The doorbell rang. She immediately tensed. But it couldn't be Con. He'd have a key. Besides, he wasn't scheduled to come by today. This was her day to pack up the last of her things. After 14 years of marriage, they now had to schedule separate time in the house they'd shared. She got to her feet and crossed the living room, opening the door. Mama, Mira, and Livy stood there, huddled together beneath the entry roof, trying to keep out of the rain. They were trying to smile, too. Neither effort was entirely successful.
A day like this, Mama said, is for family.
They surged forward in a pack. The aroma of garlic wafted up from a picnic basket on Mira's arm.
Focaccia, Mira said at Angie's look. You know that food eases every trouble.
Angie found herself smiling. How many times in her life had she come home from school, devastated by some social slight, only to hear Mama say, "Eat something, you'll feel better." Livy sidled up to her. In a black sweater and skin-tight jeans, she looked like Laura Flynn Boyle on Big Hair Day. I've been through 2 divorces. Food so doesn't help. I tried to get her to put tequila in the basket, but you know Mama.
She leaned closer. I have some Zoloft in my purse if you need it.
Come, come, Mama said, taking charge. She herded her chicks to the empty living room.
Angie felt the full weight of it then. Failure. Here was her family, looking for places to sit in an empty house that yesterday had been a home. Angie sat down on the hard, cold floor. The room was quiet now. They were waiting for her to start talking. They'd follow her lead. That was what family did. The problem was, Angie had nowhere to go and nothing to say. Her sisters would have laughed about that on any other day. Now it was hardly funny. Mira was the first to actually move. She sat down beside Angie and scooted close. The rivets on her faded jeans made a scraping noise on the floor. Mama followed, sat down on the brick hearth. Livy sat beside her. Angie looked around at their sad, knowing faces, wanting to explain it for them.
If Sophie had lived...
Don't go there, Livy said sharply. It can't help. Angie's eyes stung. She almost gave in to her pain right there, let it overwhelm her. Then she rallied. It wouldn't do any good to cry. Hell, she'd spent most of the last year in tears, and where had it gotten her?
You're right, she said. Mira took her in her arms. It was exactly what Angie needed. When she drew back, feeling somehow shakier and steadier at the same time, all 3 women were looking at her.
Can I be honest here? Livy said, opening the basket and pulling out a bottle of red wine.
Absolutely not, Angie said. Livy ignored her. You and Con have been at odds too long. Believe me, I know about love that goes bad. It was time to give up.
She began pouring the wine into glasses.
Now you should go somewhere. Take some time off.
Running away won't help, Mira said.
Bullshit, Livy responded, offering Angie a glass of wine. You've got money. Go to Rio de Janeiro. The beaches are supposed to be great and practically nude.
Angie smiled. The pinched feeling in her chest eased a little.
So I should buy a thong and show off my rapidly dropping ass?
Livy laughed. Honey, it wouldn't hurt.
For the next hour, they sat in the empty living room, drinking red wine and eating, talking about ordinary things. The weather, life in West End, Aunt Julia's upcoming surgery. Angie tried to keep up with the conversation, but she kept wondering how she'd ended up here, alone and childless at 38. The early years of her marriage had been so good.
"That's because business is bad," Livy said, pouring herself another glass of wine. "What else can we do?"
Angie drifted back to the here and now, surprised to realize that she'd left for a few minutes. She looked up. "What are you guys talking about?"
"Mama wants to sell the restaurant," Mira said.
Angie straightened.
"What?"
The restaurant was the hub of their family, the center of everything.
"We were not going to speak of it today," Mama said, shooting Mira an angry look.
Angie looked from face to face. "What in the hell is going on?"
"Don't you swear, Angela," Mama snapped.
But she sounded tired suddenly.
"Business at the restaurant is bad. I don't see how we can keep going."
"But Papa loved it," Angie said. Tears sprang into her mother's dark eyes.
"You hardly need to tell me this."
Angie looked at Livy. "What's wrong with the business?"
Livy shrugged. "The economy's bad."
"Desaria's has been doing well for 30 years. It can't be..."
"Tell me you aren't going to tell us how to run a restaurant," Livy snapped, lighting up a cigarette. "What would a copywriter know about it?"
"Creative director. And it's running a restaurant, not performing brain surgery. You just give people good food at good prices. How hard can..."
"Stop it, you two!" Mira snapped. "Mama doesn't need this."
Angie looked at her mother, but didn't know what to say. A family that only moments before had been the bedrock of her life felt suddenly cracked. They fell into silence. Angie was thinking about the restaurant, about her papa, who always had been able to make her laugh, even when her heart had felt close to rending, and about the safe world where they'd all grown up together. The restaurant was the anchor of their family. Without it, they might drift away from one another. And that, the floating on one's own tide, was a lonely way to live, Angie knew.
"Angie could help," Mama said, quietly at first.
When everyone looked at her, she said it again, more forcefully.
"She doesn't know anything about the business," Livy said. "Papa's princess. She never had..."
"Hush, Livy," Mama said, staring at Angie.
Angie understood everything in that one look. Mama was offering her a place to hide out, away from the painful memories in this city. To Mama, coming home was the answer to every question.
"Livy is right," Angie said slowly. "I don't know anything about the business."
"You helped that restaurant in Olympia. The success of your campaign made the newspapers," Mira said, studying her.
"Papa made us read all the clippings."
"Which Angie mailed to him," Livy said, exhaling smoke. Angie had helped put that restaurant back on the map, but all it had taken was a good ad campaign and some money for marketing.
"Maybe you could help us," Mira said at last.
"I don't know," Angie said. She'd left West End so long ago, certain that the whole world awaited her. How would it feel to be back?
"You could live in the beach house," Mama said.
The beach house. Angie thought about the tiny cottage on the wild, windswept coast, and a dozen treasured memories came to her, one after another. She'd always felt safe and loved there, protected. Maybe she could learn to smile again there, in that place where, as a girl, she'd laughed easily and often. She looked around her, at this too empty house that was so full of sadness. It sat on a block in a city that held too many bad memories. Maybe going home was the answer, for a while at least, until she figured out where she belonged now. She wouldn't feel alone at the cottage, not like she did in Seattle.
"Yeah," she said slowly, looking up. "I could help out for a little while."
She didn't know which emotion was sharper just then, relief or disappointment. All she knew was this: she wouldn't be alone. Mama smiled.
"Papa told me you would come back to us someday."
Livy rolled her eyes.
"Oh, great.
The princess is coming back to help us poor country bumpkins run the restaurant.
A week later, Angie was on her way. She'd set off for West End in the way she started every project, full speed ahead. First, she'd called her boss at the advertising agency and asked for a leave of absence. Her boss had stumbled around a bit, sputtering in surprise. There had been no indication at all that she was unhappy, none at all.
If it's a promotion you want,
she'd laughed at that, explaining simply that she was tired.
Tired?
She needed time off, and she had no idea how much. By the time the conversation had wound around to its end, she had simply quit. Why not? She needed to find a new life, and she could hardly do that clinging to the hemline of the old one. She had plenty of money in the bank and lots of marketable skills. When she was ready to merge back into the traffic of real life, she could always find another job. She tried not to think about how often Conlon had begged her to do this very thing. "It's killing you," he always said. "How can we relax if you're always in overdrive? The doctors say..." She cranked up the music, something old and sweet, and pressed her foot down on the accelerator. The miles sped past, each one taking her farther from Seattle and closer to the town of her youth. Finally, she turned off the interstate and followed the green Washington Beaches signs to West End. The tiny town welcomed her. Light glinted off streets and leaves that were still wet with rain. The storefronts, long ago painted in bright blues and greens and pale pinks to reflect the Victorian fishing village theme, had in time weathered to a silvery softness. As she drove down Front Street, she remembered the 4th of July parades. Every year the family had dressed up and carried a DeSaria's Restaurant banner. They'd tossed candies to the crowd. Angie had hated every moment. But now it made her smile sadly and remember her father's booming laugh.
"You are part of this family, Angela. You march!"
She rolled down her window and immediately smelled the salty tang of sea air mixed with pine. Somewhere a bakery had opened its doors. There was the merest hint of cinnamon on the breeze. The street was busy, but not crowded on this late September afternoon. No matter where you looked, people were talking animatedly to one another. Young mothers pushed their strollers together as they stopped on the street to chat. She saw Mr. Peterson, the local pharmacist, standing on the street outside his store. He waved at her, and she waved back. She knew that within minutes he would have walked next door to the hardware store and told Mr. Fisher that Angie DeSaria was back. He'd lower his voice when he said, "Poor thing. Divorce, you know." She came to a stoplight, one of four in town, and slowed. She was about to turn left toward her parents' house, but the ocean sang its siren call, and she found herself answering. Besides, she wasn't ready for the family thing yet. She turned right and followed the long, winding road out of town. To her left, the Pacific Ocean was a wind-blown gray sail that stretched to forever. Dunes and seagrass waved and fluttered in the wind. Only a mile or so from town, it became a different world. There were very few houses out here. Every now and then there were signs for a so-called resort or a collection of rental cabins perched above the sea, but even then there was nothing to be seen from the road. This stretch of shoreline, hidden amidst the towering trees and an out-of-the-way town between Seattle and Portland, hadn't been discovered yet by the yuppies, and the locals mostly couldn't afford beach property. And so it was wild here, primitive. The ocean roared its presence and reminded passers-by that once, not so very long ago, people believed dragons lived in the uncharted waters. It could be quiet sometimes, deceptively so, and in those times, tourists were lulled into a false sense of safety. They took their rented kayaks out into the rolling water and paddled back and forth. Every year, some were simply lost. Only the bright, borrowed kayaks returned. Finally, she came to an old rusted mailbox that read, Desaria. She turned onto the rutted dirt driveway. Giant trees hemmed her in on either side, blocked out most of the sky and all of the sun. The property was covered in fallen pine needles and oversized ferns. Mist coated the ground and rose upward, gave the world an impossibly softened look. She'd forgotten the mist, how it came every morning in the autumn, breathing up from the earth like a sigh made visible. Sometimes, on early morning walks, you could look down and not see your own feet. As children, they'd gone in search of that mist in the mornings, made a game out of kicking through it. She pulled up to the cottage and parked. The homecoming was so sweet and sharp, she swallowed a sudden lump in her throat. The house her father had built by hand sat in a tiny clearing, surrounded by trees that had been old when Lewis and Clark passed by this territory. The shingles, once a cedar red, had aged to the color of driftwood, silvery soft. The white trim was barely a contrast at all. When she got out of the car, she heard the symphony of her childhood summers, the sound of surf below, the whistling of the wind through the trees. Someone somewhere was flying a kite. The fluttery thwop-thwop sent her back in time. "Come on over here, princess. Help Papa trim these bushes back." "Hey, Livy, wait up! I can't run that fast!" "Mama, tell Mira to give me my marshmallows back." It was here, all those funny, angry, bittersweet moments that made up their family's history. She stood there, in the watery sunlight, surrounded by trees, soaked it all in, the memories she'd forgotten. Over there by the giant nurse log that sprouted a dozen smaller plants was where Tommy had first kissed Angie and tried to feel her up. There by the well house was the best ever hiding place for hide-and-go-seek. And there, hidden in the dark shade of two gigantic cedar trees, was the fern grotto. Two summers ago, she and Conlon had brought all of the nieces and nephews out here for a campout. They'd built a fort amid the huge ferns and pretended to be pirates. They'd told elaborate ghost stories that night, all of them gathered around a bonfire, roasting marshmallows and making s'mores. Back then, she'd still believed that someday she'd bring her own children here. With a sigh, she carried her luggage into the house. The downstairs was one big room, a kitchen off to the left, with butter-yellow cabinets and white-tile countertops, a small dining area tucked into the corner. Somehow all five of them had eaten at that tiny table, and a living room that took up the rest of the space. A giant river rock fireplace dominated the east-facing wall. Around it were clustered a pair of overstuffed blue sofas, a battered pine coffee table, and Papa's worn leather chair. There was no television at the cottage. Never had been. "We talk," Papa had always said when his daughters complained. "Hey, Papa," she whispered. The only answer was wind, tapping gently on the window panes. Tap, tap, tap. It was the sound a rocking chair made on a hardwood floor in an unused room. She tried to outrun the memories, but they were too fast. She felt her control slipping away. With every breath she took, it seemed that time marched on, moved away from her. Her youth was leaving her, as impossible to grasp as the air she breathed in her lonely bed at night. She let out a heavy breath. She'd been a fool to think things would be different here. Why would it? Memories didn't live on streets or in cities. They flowed in the blood, pulsed with your heartbeat. She'd brought it all with her, every loss and heartache. The weight of it bowed her back, exhausted her. She climbed the stairs and went into her parents' old bedroom. The sheets and blankets were off the bed, of course, no doubt stored in a box in the closet, and the mattress was dusty, but Angie didn't care. She crawled up onto the bed and curled into a ball. This hadn't been a good idea, after all, coming home. She closed her eyes, listening to the bees buzzing outside her window, and tried to fall asleep. The next morning, Angie woke with the sun. She stared up at the ceiling, watching a fat black wolf spider spinning its web. Her eyes felt gritty and swollen. Once again, she'd watered her pillow with memories. Enough was enough. It was a decision she'd made hundreds of times in the last year. This time, she was determined to mean it. She opened the suitcase, found a change of clothes, and headed for the bathroom. After a hot shower, she felt human again. She brushed her hair into a ponytail, dressed in a pair of faded jeans and a red turtleneck sweater, and grabbed her purse off the kitchen table. She was just about to leave for town when she happened to glance out the window. Outside, Mama sat on a fallen log at the edge of the property, a heavy sweater tucked around her shoulders. She was talking to someone, using her hands in those wild gestures that had so embarrassed Angie in her youth. No doubt the whole family was arguing about whether Angie could be of any use at the restaurant. After last night, she had to agree with them. She knew that when she stepped out onto the porch, it would sound like a lawnmower, all those voices raised in disagreement. They would spend an hour arguing over the pros and cons of Angie's return. Her opinion would hardly matter. She paused at the back door, gathering courage. Forcing a smile, she opened the door and went outside, looking for the crowd. There was no one here except Mama. Frowning, Angie crossed the yard and sat down on the log. "Hey, Mama. Where is everyone?"
"We knew you'd come out sooner or later," Mama answered.
"We?"
"Your papa and me."
Angie sighed. So her mother was still talking to Papa. Grief was something Angie knew well. She could hardly blame her mother for refusing to let go. Still, she couldn't help wondering if this was something to worry about. She touched her mother's hand. The skin was loose and soft. "So what does he have to say about me being home?" Mama sighed in obvious relief.
"Your sisters ask me to see a doctor. You ask me what Papa has to say. Oh, Angela, I'm glad you're home."
She pulled Angie into a hug. For the first time, Mama wasn't dressed to the nines and layered in clothes. She wore only a cable-knit sweater and an old pair of Jordache jeans. Angie could feel how thin she'd gotten, and it worried her. "You've lost more weight," she said, drawing back.
"Of course. For 47 years I eat dinner with my husband. Alone is hard. Then you and I will eat together."
"I'm alone, too."
"Are you staying?"
"What do you mean?"
"Livy thinks you need someone to take care of you and a place to hide out for a few days. Running a restaurant in trouble is not easy. She thinks you'll be gone in a day or two."
Angie could tell that Livy spoke for others in the family, and she wasn't surprised. None of them understood the kind of dreams that sent a girl in search of a different life, or the kind of heartache that could turn her around and send her home again. They'd always worried that her ambition was too sharp somehow, that it would cut her. "What do you think?" Mama bit down on her lip, worried it in a gesture as familiar as the sound of the sea.
"Papa says he's waited 20 years for you to take over his baby, his restaurant, and he doesn't want anyone to get in your way."
Angie smiled. That sounded so much like Papa. For a second, she almost believed he was here with them, standing in the shadows of his beloved trees. She sighed, wishing she could hear his voice again. But there was only the sound of the ocean roaring up to the sand. She couldn't help thinking about last night and all the tears she'd shed.
"I don't know if I'm strong enough yet to help you." "He loved to sit here and watch the ocean," Mama said, leaning against her. "We have to fix those stairs, Maria. That's what he said first thing every summer."
"Did you hear me? Last night was hard.
We made a lot of changes every summer. This place never looked the same 2 years in a row.
I know, but it always started with the one thing. Just fixing the stairs.
Just the stairs, huh? Angie said, finally smiling. The longest journey begins with a single step and all that.
Some sayings are simply true.
But what if I don't know where to start?
You will.
Mama put an arm around her. They sat that way a long time, leaning against each other, staring out to sea. Finally, Angie said,
How did you know I was here, by the way?
Mr. Peterson saw you drive through town.
And so it begins. Angie smiled, remembering the web that connected the residents in this town. Once, at the homecoming dance, she'd let Tommy Matucci put his hands on her butt. The news had reached Mama before the dance was over.
She heard a car drive up. She glanced back at the house. A forest green minivan pulled into the yard.
Mira got out of the car. She was wearing a faded pair of denim overalls and an old Metallica t-shirt. In her arms were a pile of account books.
No time like the present to get started, she said, but you better read 'em fast before Livy realizes they're gone.
You see, Mama said, bumping her gently, family will always show you where to begin. Now, get started.
Chapter 3 A drizzly rain fell on the brick courtyard of Fircrest Academy, giving everything a shiny, lacquered appearance. Standing beneath the flagpole, Lauren Ribido looked at her watch for at least the 10th time in as many minutes. It was 6:15. Her mother had promised to be here for the college fair by 5:30. She couldn't believe she'd fallen for the pretty promises again. She knew better. Happy hour at the Tides Tavern didn't end until 6:30. So why did it still hurt after all these years? You'd think a heart would grow calluses at some point. She turned away from the empty road and headed toward the gymnasium. She was almost to the doors when she heard a male voice call her name.
David.
She spun around, already smiling. He got out of the passenger side of a new black Cadillac Escalade and slammed the door shut with his hip. He was dressed up, wearing blue Dockers and a yellow cashmere sweater. Even with his blonde hair plastered wetly to his head, he was the best-looking guy in school.
"I thought you'd be inside already," he said, running up to her.
"My mom didn't show."
"Again?"
She hated the tears that burned her eyes.
"It's no big deal."
He pulled her into a bear hug, and for those few moments, her world was okay.
"How about your dad?" she asked gently, hoping just this once Mr. Haynes had come through for David.
"Nope. Someone has to denude the rainforest." She heard the bitterness in his voice and started to say, "I love you." The sound of high heels on concrete stopped her.
"Hello, Lauren."
She eased out of David's arms and looked up at his mother, who was trying not to frown.
"Hello, Mrs. Haynes."
"Where is your mother?" she asked, settling an expensive brown handbag over her shoulder as she glanced around. Lauren flashed on an image of her mother's most likely location, slumped on a bar stool in the Tides, smoking a bummed cigarette.
"She had to work late."
"On college fair night?" Lauren hated the way Mrs. Haynes looked at her then. It was the "poor Lauren, so pathetic" look. She'd seen it her whole life. Adults, especially women, were always wanting to mother her. In the beginning, at least. Sooner or later, they moved on to their own lives, their own families, leaving Lauren somehow more alone than she'd been before.
"She can't help it," Lauren said.
"That's more than I can say for Dad," David said to his mother.
"Now, David," Mrs. Haynes said with a heavy sigh, "you know your father would be here if he could."
"Yeah, right."
He hooked an arm around Lauren's shoulder and drew her close. She let herself be swept across the wet courtyard and into the gymnasium.
Every step of the way, she focused on positive thoughts. She refused to let her mother's absence impact self-confidence. Tonight, of all nights, she had to keep her eye on the goalpost, and a college scholarship to the same school David chose was the touchdown. A field goal was a school nearby. She was committed to achieving this goal, and when she was committed, she could move mountains. She was here, wasn't she? A senior at one of the best private schools in Washington State, and on a full scholarship to boot. She'd made her choice in sixth grade when she moved to West End from Los Angeles. Back then, she'd been a shy girl, too embarrassed by her horn-rimmed charity eyeglasses and secondhand clothes to say much. Once, long ago, she'd made the mistake of asking her mother for help. "I can't wear these shoes anymore, Mommy. Rain is getting in the holes."
"If you're like me, you'll get used to it," had been Mom's response.
Those four words, "if you're like me," had been enough to change the course of Lauren's life. The next day, she set about changing herself and her life. Project Geek No More had begun. She did chores for all the neighbors in the rundown apartment complex in which they lived, feeding the cats for old Mrs. Teabody and 4A, cleaning the kitchen for Mrs. Mock, carrying packages upstairs for Mrs. Parmeter in 6C. $1 at a time, she saved up money for contact lenses and new clothes. "My," the optometrist had said on the big day, "you have the most gorgeous brown eyes I've ever seen." Once she looked like everyone else, she set about acting correctly. She started with smiles, and then graduated to waves, and finally, hellos. She volunteered for everything, as long as apparent contact wasn't required. By the time she started junior high, her hard work had begun to pay off. She'd earned her full ride to Fircrest Academy, a Catholic school with a strict uniform code. There, she worked even harder. She was voted class secretary in ninth grade, and had retained an office every year since. In high school, she organized every school dance, took photos for the annual, ran the student body as senior class president, and lettered in both gymnastics and volleyball. She'd fallen in love with David on their first date almost 4 years ago now. She stared into the gym, which was packed with people. To Lauren, it looked as if she were the only student here without a parent. It was a feeling she was used to. Nonetheless, it made her smile falter. She couldn't help looking back at the flagpole. Her mother still wasn't there. David squeezed her hand. "Well, Trixie, are we ready?" It made her smile, that little nickname. He knew how nervous she was right now. She leaned into him. "Let's go, Speed Racer." Mrs. Haynes came up beside them.
"Do you have a pen, Lauren, and some paper?"
"Yes, ma'am," she answered. It embarrassed her how much that simple question meant to her.
"I don't have a pen," David said, grinning.
Mrs. Haynes handed him a pen and led the way forward. They merged into the stream of traffic. As always, the crowd parted for them. They were the senior couple. The pair voted most likely to stay in love. Dozens of friends waved or said hi. They went from booth to booth, picking up literature and talking to the representatives. As always, David did everything he could to help Lauren. He told everyone he saw about her stellar grades and achievements. He was certain she'd be offered countless scholarships. In his world, things came easily, and in that world, it was easy to believe in happy endings. He stopped at the Ivy League schools first. When Lauren looked at pictures of those venerable campuses, she felt queasy. She prayed he didn't decide to go to Harvard or Princeton. She could never fit in there, even if she could get accepted. Not there, in those halls where the girls were named after food products and everyone had parents who believed in education. Still, she smiled her prettiest smile and took the brochures. A girl like her needed to make a good impression at all times. There was no room for error in her life. At last, they headed for the Holy Grail, the Stanford booth. Lauren heard Mrs. Haynes's trailing voice as she marched ahead of them. "The wing named after your grandfather." Lauren stumbled along beside them. It took pure willpower to keep her posture good and her smile in place. David would